place of action, adventure, and professional opportunity, but also as a place untethered from headquarters and lacking the prestige and centrality of Moscow, Berlin, or Beijing. After many years in Africa, Black's manner had become theatrical and self-dramatizing. He was a sort of CIA officer one would expect to encounter in an Oliver Stone film. His years abroad had left him with a hard-to-place accent. A touch of South Africa seemed evident. He had proven to be an effective office politician as he rose within CIA. He had a subtler intelligence than his melodramatic speech might suggest, and because he could be funny and generous, he had won the loyalty of senior colleagues. George Tenet had sent him to run CTC in 1999, at a time when the Seventh Floor, as the CIA's leadership was known, was becoming highly alarmed about Al-Qaeda. Black was not a Harvard Business School-inspired manager. Even more than most operations officers, who as a class prided themselves on their ability to freelance and improvise, Black considered it his mission to bend or ignore the CIA's bureaucracy, to concentrate on action and operations. Yet he also managed to keep key superiors on his side. As Khartoum Station Chief, Black had overseen intelligence collection operations against Osama bin Laden. He tried to infuse CTC with the spirit of streetwise operational gusto that Africa Division considered as its trademark. He brought in Hank Crumpton, who had spent more than a decade as an operations officer in Africa, as his principal deputy. At Alex Station, he inherited Rich Blee, another familiar Africa hand. They recruited others from their old division as well. At 8 a.m. on September 11, 2001, Kofor Black convened a regular briefing meeting in his office. Each week, CTC presented three separate update briefings on Al-Qaeda to CIA Director George Tenet, James Pavitt, the head of the clandestine service, and A.B. Buzzy Krongard, the agency's executive director. Black asked for a read-in on each briefing before it was delivered. That morning, they were scheduled to provide their weekly update to Krongard. Rich Blee walked into Black's office. He was preoccupied by the aftermath of Ahmad Shah Massoud's assassination. Despite Amrullah Saleh's brave talk, Blee figured that without Massoud's leadership, the Panjshiri resistance to the Taliban would soon collapse. It seemed doubtful that the Bush administration would do anything to prevent that. Yet Blee owed Saleh an answer. Also at the meeting was the head of analysis at CTC, Ben Bonk. He was a Detroit native who evangelized about its Corvettes and sports teams, and who had become a specialist in South Asia and Central Asia, at one point serving as national intelligence officer for the region. Just after 8:46 a.m., Black's secretary came in to say that a private plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. Black was a licensed pilot, like his father. Glancing at the news coverage on a television mounted in the corner of his office, he could see a hole in the World Trade Center's north tower. The weather looked clear. He figured the accident involved a light aircraft and that the pilot might have committed suicide. It was an oddity, not necessarily an act of terrorism. A little before 9 a.m., several visitors arrived outside Kofor Black's office. They had no appointment, but they wanted to make a short courtesy call. The group included U.S. Navy Commander Kirk Lippold, who had been at the helm of the USS Cole the previous October, when Al-Qaeda suicide bombers attacked the ship. He had driven over to the CIA that morning to receive an update from agency analysts about Al-Qaeda. Just as he prepared to greet Lippold, a phone on Black's desk rang. His desk had several secure telephone lines, and he wasn't sure how all of them worked. Yet he knew that the one ringing was a non-secure phone for sources or contacts that he didn't want to route through the CIA switchboard. Most of the time when that line rang, the callers were selling credit cards or oil changes. He picked it up. It was an old friend, an officer from the CIA's paramilitary division. They had worked together during the Angolan War. His friend had since risen to a senior position at the agency. He happened that morning to be visiting the CIA's station in New York, which was located in an office building next to the World Trade Center. "Hey, Chief, we've got a problem," the officer said. I watched this 737-like civilian airliner. I was watching the control surfaces of the aircraft. The pilot flew it into the World Trade Center. He spoke in the clipped vernacular of battlefield operations. We've been struck. I'm evacuating my position. Rich Blee walked across the hall to Alex Station's cluster of cubicles. That's bin Laden, or Al-Qaeda, he said, pointing to a nearby television hanging from the ceiling. You can't say that, one of his colleagues objected. It could be an accident. Every time something happens, you can't say that it's Al-Qaeda. They stood around arguing. There was a split verdict within Alex Station, but most of the analysts credited the possibility of an accident. ALEC analysts had written warning report after warning report, briefing slide after briefing slide, for the White House and the Bush cabinet. They had provided insights for the article in the president's daily brief received by George W. Bush on August 6, 2001, headlined, Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. It's Bin Laden, Blee insisted to his colleagues. They were still arguing among themselves at 9:03 a.m., when United Airlines Flight 175 struck the World Trade Center's South Tower. George Tenet raced up the George Washington Parkway to CIA headquarters at about 80 miles an hour. His security detail had pulled him out of a breakfast at a downtown hotel after the first plane hit. Tenet called ahead and asked for the agency's senior leaders to assemble in 7D64, the director's conference room at old headquarters. Cofer Black grabbed an experienced administrative colleague on the CTC staff as he prepared to head upstairs. Wherever I go today, you come right with me, he told her. No matter who's there, you come in. I want you to write down every order people give me, because I'm not going to remember them all. At 9:37 a.m., American Airlines Flight 77 struck the Pentagon while flying about 530 miles per hour. In Tenet's conference room, there was a lot of yelling and screaming as Charles Allen, a 65-year-old agency veteran in charge of intelligence collection, put it. We have to get out of here, one senior officer exclaimed. They're heading for us. At 9:40 a.m., Black and Deputy CIA Director John McLaughlin spoke by secure video link with Richard Clark, the lead counterterrorism expert at the White House. Clark said the Federal Aviation Administration was uncertain how many other planes might have been hijacked and still in the air. Several planes were not responding to air controllers or were squawking signals that might indicate a hijack. There were rumors of a car bombing at the State Department. CTC officers who accompanied Black upstairs mentioned to the group in 7D64 that Ramzi Youssef, the ringleader of the car bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, had once discussed flying a Cessna packed with explosives into CIA headquarters. And here they all were, packed in together on the building's highest floor. Let's get out of here, the head of Tenet's personal security detail recommended. Let's evacuate. Should we leave? Tenet asked his senior team. We should stay here and work on, Charles Allen argued. Where are we going to go? Tenet had risen in Washington as a staff member on Capitol Hill, known for his charisma and his succinct, colorful briefings. He explained later that he didn't want the world to think we were abandoning ship, yet he didn't want to risk the lives of our own people unnecessarily, and we needed to have our leadership intact and able to make decisions. He ordered the senior team downstairs. Around 10 a.m., he directed CIA personnel to evacuate the grounds. Within minutes, every computer at the agency flashed evacuate in red. Intelligence officers trudged down the stairwells. The evacuation did not sit well with all of them. It felt like running away. When they got outside, they saw a huge traffic jam as several thousand employees tried to drive out of the campus simultaneously. During the Cold War, the CIA had maintained a secret, bunkered alternate campus to which its leaders could retreat in the event of nuclear war. The alternate campus had been eliminated from the federal budget after the fall of the Berlin Wall. The CIA and its budgeters in Congress had failed to prepare for an emergency on this scale. Tenet's office had the agency's printing plan on the Langley campus as a nearby emergency site if needed. Charles Allen's office had been working to build a new survivable emergency site away from the campus for the CIA and other critical agencies of government, but this was still a work in progress. Tenet now led a march of senior officers toward the CIA printing plant, an outbuilding across the campus. When they reached there, a technician set up a secure terminal equipment, or STE line, to the White House. Tenet raised Stephen Hadley, the deputy national security advisor. President Bush was by now in the air aboard Air Force One, en route to a Louisiana air base. Vice President Dick Cheney had been hustled into a White House bunker. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was inside the smoldering Pentagon. Secretary of State Colin Powell was traveling in Latin America. The country's leaders communicated only sporadically, and the attack still seemed to be in progress. Hadley insisted that Tenet keep the STE line open to the White House continuously. Because that channel was occupied, Charles Allen had no way to collect securely the latest intercept reports from the National Security Agency about who might be responsible for the airplane hijackings. Michael Hayden, the NSA director, wanted to send over reports providing preliminary evidence that Al-Qaeda was responsible. Allen sent an NSA liaison officer back into CIA headquarters to pull these reports off a secure fax machine and bring them to the printing plant. Tenet talked to leaders at the FBI, the Federal Aviation Administration, State, the National Security Agency, and other counterparts. He also tried to determine whether any CIA officers in the New York station had been killed. None had, it turned out. Kofor Black finally cornered him. All summer, it had been obvious from intelligence reporting that something big and bad was coming. For weeks, Black had been thinking about how he would handle this day. He had tried to imagine in advance a moment of great pressure when a lot of people would be dead, and he would have to speak forcefully to CTC's workforce and to his superiors on the seventh floor. "Sir, we're going to have to exempt CTC from the CIA-wide evacuation," Black told Tenet. "They would also need to exempt personnel from the Office of Technical Services, which supported CTC. We need to have our people working the computers." "They're going to be at risk," Tenet answered. "We're going to have to keep them in place. They have the key function to play in a crisis like this." "Well, they could die." "Well, sir, then they're just going to have to die." Tenet thought it over and replied, "You're absolutely right." Black walked back toward new headquarters into the swarm of evacuating CIA employees. Inside CTC, Black said that their job now was to explain to the president and his cabinet what had just happened to the United States, who did it, and what might be coming next. The Federal Aviation Administration had a liaison officer at CTC. He could access airline passenger manifests. Rich Blee and his ALEC station analysts were by now certain that Al-Qaeda had carried out the hijackings, but to make that call firmly for the White House, they needed proof. Blee asked the liaison officer to access the FAA's computers and obtain passenger lists for the four known aircraft seized by hijackers. The officer said he could not do that. These were American airliners filled with American citizens, and under the law, the CIA could not access private information about U.S. persons, he maintained. Blee was beside himself. He asked FBI agents deployed to ALEC Station to see what they could obtain through the Bureau's channels. The Hezbollah branch's analysts at CTC were as certain as the ALEC team that the hijackings had been carried out by their terrorists. The attack was a sophisticated, complex operation that required planning and resources. Hezbollah had thousands of fighters in southern Lebanon and a worldwide network strong enough to pull off such a feat. Just a week or two earlier, the branch's analysts had placed a provocative article in the classified National Intelligence Digest, arguing that Hezbollah was a more serious threat to the United States than Al-Qaeda. During the past two decades, Hezbollah units had bombed American facilities in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Lebanon. the death toll from Hezbollah attacks since the 1980s was higher than the death toll from al-Qaeda strikes, the article had pointed out. This is Mugniya, one of the Hezbollah analysts assured Blee, referring to Imad Mugniya, then the notorious fugitive leader of Hezbollah's Islamic Jihad organization. It's not Mugniya, Blee said. Intelligence about a spectacular al-Qaeda attack had been piling up all summer from multiple sources. There was no comparable threat stream about Hezbollah. Yet the Hezbollah analysts were adamant. Go for it, Blee finally said. Prove your case. The analysts in Alex Station's cubicles all knew the history of Ramzi Youssef, the architect of the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. It was 2 years after that when Youssef had also discussed flying a plane into CIA headquarters. The husband of one analyst worked at the Pentagon, which was now in flames. Other analysts had children at home or school. Blee decided to speak to the group. He was not an easy man to read. He could be blunt. This morning he tried to be calm. The sensation of being under fire was not new to him. But for many Washington-bound analysts at ALEC, this was a first. Blee told them he understood that not everyone would feel that they could stay at work, that some had families they would feel they needed to serve first. It was okay to leave, he said. Still, he continued, the country needs you. We need you. It's hard, but try to stay here. Blee had been reflecting on the fact that a hijacked plane might strike CIA headquarters at any minute. Yet he felt they would survive. A plane would have to fly above the treetops around the CIA campus, and so it would almost inevitably strike the new headquarters' upper floors. Even if the building pancaked, Blee figured, CTC's bunker-like ground floor would survive intact for a while, and there would be time to get outside. Here, at last, was a reason to be grateful for this miserable office space. Five planes could land on CIA, Blee thought, and his workforce would probably crawl out unharmed, like cockroaches. One of the analysts on the team asked him about the CIA's defenses. One of those planes is probably headed our way. Are there surface-to-air missiles on the roof? Sure there are surface-to-air missiles, Blee lied. They've got them at the White House. They've got them here, too. His response was spontaneous. He was trying to keep Alec together. Also, lying effectively was part of the case officer's profession. We're going to war, Blee said. Alec's days of isolation were over. They would soon be catapulted to the center of national decision-making. Any proposals for attacking al-Qaeda that had earlier been turned down by the 7th floor or the White House should be revived and reconsidered. Use your imagination, Blee said. All but two of the Alec Station employees stayed at their desks, according to the recollections of Blee's colleagues. By noon it was clear that the threat of additional kamikaze attacks on Washington had passed. The FBI sent over the passenger manifests for the four hijacked airliners by about 1 p.m. Alec Station's analysts typically divided their work by geographical region. Some covered Asia, others the Middle East or Africa. An FBI analyst on assignment to CIA kept track of al-Qaeda's domestic ties. Just a few weeks earlier, while reviewing old cable traffic, she had recognized that a known al-Qaeda associate, Khalid al-Midhar, had obtained an American visa and flown to the United States in early 2000. She had asked the FBI to look for Midhar and a colleague, Nawaf al-Hazmi, but the search had barely started. Now the analyst saw their names on the American 77 passenger list. She approached Blee. Here's the smoking gun, she said. Did September 11th vindicate the CIA's warnings about al-Qaeda, or expose its failure to prevent a disaster the agency might have stopped? Tenet, Black, and Blee warned the Bush administration about al-Qaeda clearly and repeatedly during 2001. They were not the only people in the government to issue such warnings. Richard Clark at the National Security Council repeatedly urged Condoleezza Rice and other Bush administration leaders to focus on bin Laden and take more aggressive action. Al-Qaeda specialists at the FBI and the Justice Department also understood well the threat bin Laden posed. In the two decades before 2001, the CIA had sometimes failed in its mission to alert presidents in advance to strategic risks and threats abroad. The agency's analysts were late to recognize the forces that swept the Soviet Union away. They were timid about Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev's potential as a reformer. The agency failed to detect or predict India's decision to test a nuclear bomb in 1998. On Al-Qaeda, however, in 2001, the CIA had the big picture right and communicated warnings forcefully. In late June, CTC had alerted all station chiefs worldwide about the possibility of an imminent suicide attack, and Tenet asked the chiefs to brief every ambassador. Over the last several months, we have seen unprecedented indications that bin Laden and his supporters have been preparing for a terrorist operation, that CTC bulletin reported. Other CIA warning reports that month carried the headlines, "Bin Laden attacks may be imminent," and "Bin Laden and associates making near-term threats." A daily CIA analytical product, the Senior Executive Intelligence Brief, carried an article on June 30th entitled, "Bin Laden Planning High-Profile Attacks." The CIA did not know when or where the attack would occur, however. Blee said that bin Laden's pattern in the past had been to have his suicide cells attack only when they were ready, not according to any hard schedule. Based on the totality of the intelligence available, Blee said, "Attack preparations have been made. Multiple and simultaneous attacks are possible, and they will occur with little or no warning." Yet they had no concrete evidence of a plan to strike inside the United States. Their best guess was that Al-Qaeda would continue with its established pattern of striking American embassies or defense facilities abroad. Why did the CIA have so little insight into the U.S. plot? Despite several years of field operations and the recruitment of more than 100 reporting agents inside Afghanistan, Alex Station had not penetrated bin Laden's planning. Al-Qaeda's counterintelligence against potential moles was formidable. In counterterrorism, strategic warning is vital, but tactical warning about dates and places saves lives. The CIA had not attained that fidelity about Al-Qaeda. Worse, as the FBI analysts' instant recognition of the smoking gun names on the Flight 77 passenger manifest indicated, agency analysts had possessed for 21 months intelligence that might have led to the disruption of the September 11th conspiracy. Yet CIA analysts in multiple stations and branches had failed to act adequately on its importance. In late 1999, operatives working with Malaysia's Special Branch Police had photographed clandestinely a meeting of suspected Al-Qaeda associates in Kuala Lumpur. In January, they discovered Mihdhar's name and the fact that he had a visa to travel to the United States. In March, they learned his colleague Hazmi's name as well, and the fact that both men had already flown to Los Angeles. Yet they took no action until August 2001. Soon after the information about Mihdhar and Hazmi was discovered, Doug Miller and Mark Rossini, FBI agents assigned to Alec, drafted a cable reporting the facts to the FBI. But a CIA officer blocked them from releasing the cable. It is unclear why. The failure to detect and locate Mihdhar and Hazmi would catalyze blame shifting between the CIA and the FBI for years to come. According to an investigation by the CIA's Office of Inspector General completed in 2005, but not declassified for another 10 years, 50 to 60 individuals read one or more of 6 different CIA cables containing travel information related to these terrorists, meaning Mihdhar and Hazmi. A majority of those who read the cables worked at CTC. They were mainly CIA analysts, but also included 4 FBI agents on assignment to the agency. The CIA failed to place either Midhar or Hazmi on a State Department-managed terrorist watch list that might have caused the men to be denied entry to the United States or refused visas. The list was not as significant as watch lists would become after September 11th. It did not have a no-fly provision that airlines could automatically access as passengers checked in, for example. Midhar left the United States once after his initial arrival and then returned. So if he had been on the State Department list, he might have been refused entry the second time. That so many individuals failed to act in this case reflects a systemic breakdown. A breakdown caused by excessive workload, ambiguities about responsibilities, and mismanagement of the program, the CIA Inspector General's investigators later concluded. Basically, there was no coherent, functioning watchlisting program. The investigators recommended that a CIA accountability board review Kofor Black, among others, for failing to perform to professional standards, but Porter Goss, the CIA's director when the recommendation was made, chose not to do so. Goss's view was, first, that he was not interested in reprimanding anyone who was no longer at CIA. Black had left government by then. Second, Goss noted that no other agency involved in Homeland Security before September 11th, not the FBI, not the Pentagon, not the Federal Aviation Administration, had felt it necessary to single out any individual for responsibility. Later email records suggest CIA officers believe the information about Midhar and Hazmi had been conveyed to the FBI. CIA analysts told the Inspector General that they had communicated the details informally over the telephone. Yet there is no documentary evidence to support these recollections, according to the Inspector General. His investigators found no evidence and heard no claim from any party that this information was shared in any manner with the FBI or that anyone in Alex Station took other appropriate operational action at that time. Well into 2001, various analysts reviewed the files, but failed to recognize the significance of their information until it was too late. These failures are an indelible part of the what-if history of September 11th. The possibility that the attacks might have been stopped, that thousands of lives might have been spared, and that America's foreign policy might not have pivoted in costly directions. Yet that counterfactual requires a context. The gross domestic product of the United States in 2001 was about $10.6 trillion. The budget of the federal government was about $1.8 trillion. In fiscal 2001, the government enjoyed a $128 billion operating surplus. Yet counterterrorism teams at the CIA and the FBI, working on Al-Qaeda and allied groups, received an infinitesimal fraction of the country's defense and intelligence budget of roughly $300 billion, the great majority of which went to the Pentagon to support conventional and missile forces. Bush's national security deputies did not hold a meeting dedicated to plans to thwart Al-Qaeda until September 4, 2001, almost 9 months after President Bush took the oath of office. The September 11th conspiracy succeeded in part because the democratically elected government of the United States, including the Congress, did not regard Al-Qaeda as a priority. In the first days and months after the attack, in any event, the country had scant appetite for reflection or accountability. President Bush needed answers and plans for retaliation, and the CIA had them. September 11th empowered the counter-terrorist center and its leaders. It put the CIA in a commanding position within the Bush National Security Cabinet, with a degree of influence over national policy the agency had not enjoyed at the White House since the days of anti-communist proxy guerrilla war during the 1980s. Overnight, Kofor Black and Rich Blee and their colleagues, promoted by their persuasive boss, George Tenet, became vital authors of American military and foreign policy. They proceeded under certain assumptions. They believed that CTC's covert action against bin Laden after 1998 had been hamstrung by caution and fecklessness at the White House and among the CIA's leaders. They feared what might be coming next, and believed they had to act quickly. Their aggression in the coming weeks was not about violence, Black insisted later, although we used the vocabulary of violence to shock and impress and inspire various constituencies. They needed to move fast in order to cause Al-Qaeda's leaders to turn their attention away from planning or executing follow-on attacks, to concentrate instead on self-preservation. The gloves are off, they told colleagues, a phrase that rapidly spread around the agency and the capital as a dangerous, facile cliché. The professional histories of Black, Blee, and others in leadership at the Counterterrorist Center that September included long exposure to unconventional war in Africa, arming and training proxy armies, working behind the scenes with small teams of paramilitaries, empowering strongmen while accepting that few guerrilla leaders were morally admirable. They preferred to let the locals carry the fight, enabled by the CIA's money and technology, following a script that traced back to the secret operations of the Office of Strategic Services during the Second World War, which laid the CIA's foundations. The Defense Department typically required weeks or months to build the logistics tail to support overseas ground operations. The CIA's value to the White House over decades, part myth, part valid history, had always been that 100 operations officers with M4 rifles could go anywhere in a week and create mayhem without a lot of care and feeding. Black's conception of the CIA as the anti-military, as he put it, required improvising very fast. The American public, shocked and angry on September 11th, ready to support retaliation, had no acquaintance with the men in the CTC bunker. Yet the center's leaders would define the country's initial reply to bin Laden, a paramilitary war in Afghanistan, a counter-terrorist campaign against Al-Qaeda worldwide. And they would influence many of the legal, political, and diplomatic strategies that would shape those campaigns. The coming war in Afghanistan would follow Africa Division rules. Shortly after 3 p.m. on September 11th, Tenet told President Bush during a secure video conference that the CIA was certain Al-Qaeda had carried out the hijackings. He went through the names and case histories of Mihdhar and Hazmi, and the fact that they had been passengers on Flight 77. This was an Al-Qaeda operation, the CIA director reported. Rich Blee called Amrullah Saleh in Dushanbe on their secure line. Saleh had been watching the news coverage, but he wasn't sure what the attacks would mean for America's willingness to arm the Council of the North. Saleh certainly did not expect the United States to invade Afghanistan. At most, if Massoud's men were lucky, the CIA might open its checkbook a little more generously, he thought. Saleh had made more lists since his last call with Blee. He had written up an inventory of weapons and military gear the Panjshiri guerrillas might need to hold the valley against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Saleh started to read off his list. Blee interrupted him. This is a tragedy for my country, but it is going to change your country forever, Blee said. The American response to the hijackings was going to involve much more than an increased supply of grenades and helicopters. This is now much beyond you, Blee continued. Consult your leaders, because this is going to come in ways, in scope, and in scale, that you cannot imagine. There was a psychologist working at CTC, an expert on terrorism. She mentioned to Kofor Black that he should probably talk to the center's workforce to address their emotions. Black asked her to walk around a little and take in the mood. Should I give one of my motivational speeches? He asked after she had done so. These aren't operators, she advised him. They need reassurance. You're their father. Speak to them like that. Black was accustomed to supervising case officers doing risky work. The style of speech these officers appreciated was derived from fired-up football coaches exhorting young men in locker rooms. Yet the CTC analysts at new headquarters in Virginia had graduate degrees. They did not respond especially well to entering the jaws of hell talk. Black made some notes. He called the workforce together on September 13th. It really pains me to tell you this, but by the time this is all over, At the victory parade? We will not all be there, Black said. He guessed privately that around 4 or 5 dozen CIA personnel would perish or be captured in the coming fight in Afghanistan and elsewhere. He was trying to sensitize the group to the losses he foresaw, and to encourage them to appreciate the friends and colleagues they saw in the hallway. There was silence. A few wept. He tried to lighten the mood. He told them what he had been doing over the last 48 hours. He had met with President Bush. The president had already given him a nickname, Heifer, because apparently Bush couldn't remember Kofor, and I am sort of a hefty guy. Black also told them that his favorite movie was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, a 1989 science fiction comedy about two teenage slackers who use a time machine to travel through history. Even those around him who were crying laughed. Be excellent to each other, Black went on. Give everyone a break. We're all doing the best we can. He was thinking about a colleague on the analytical side of CTC who had reported that her neighbor had confronted her and told her that she was partly responsible for September 11th, sending her into tears. These were dark days, Black felt. Many in CTC were racked by guilt. The emotions were raw. And he struggled, too, to hold a measured tone. He added, If you remember one thing from this, I'd like it to be that we're the good guys, and we're going to win. Chapter 3 Friends Like These Dave Smith had an office on the third floor of the United States Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan, near the CIA station, in the Chancery's secure area. In September 2001, he was 10 months into his fourth deployment to Pakistan. His business card read, Colonel David O. Smith, United States Army Attaché. This was slightly fictitious. He had served in the Army for 30 years and had risen to the rank of colonel but had recently retired. The Defense Intelligence Agency had recruited him as a civilian under a program designed to improve Pentagon reporting from hard countries, including Pakistan. After some rumination, the Pentagon's lawyers had signed off on a plan to allow Smith to call himself an active United States Army officer and even to wear his uniform in Pakistan when the occasion required. The DIA was the Pentagon's intelligence arm, headquartered at Bowling Air Force Base, adjacent to Washington's low-income Anacostia neighborhoods. Its collectors and analysts provided intelligence to the Secretary of Defense and uniformed commanders, as well as to the White House and other government customers. The DIA's budget dwarfed the CIA's, but it had none of Langley's fame and little of its influence. Its leaders struggled to reconcile the requirements of military discipline with the law-skirting tradecraft of human intelligence collection, or HUMINT. Yet the DIA housed some of America's most experienced, best-sourced experts on foreign armies, among other subjects. Dave Smith was one. He was a meticulous, balding man then in his mid-50s. He was easily overlooked, useful for an intelligence officer. He had grown up in Missouri, where his father worked at an oil refinery. His ancestors had fought in many American wars, but Smith was the first in his family to graduate from college, and the first to be commissioned as an officer. He served initially in the artillery, but later joined the Army's Foreign Area Officer Program. It deployed mid-ranking officers to embassies worldwide, where they collected information on host country militaries and their intelligence wings. In 1982, Smith enrolled at the Pakistan Army's prestigious Command and Staff College in Quetta, where he befriended Pakistani officers on track for promotion. He kept up those relationships when he deployed to the United States Embassy in Islamabad as an attaché in the late 1980s, just as the CIA's covert action program to thwart the Soviet Union in Afghanistan was winding down, and then again in the mid-1990s as the Taliban rose to power. By the time the DIA recruited Smith in late 2000 to return to Islamabad under light cover, the Pakistan Army officers he had first met almost 2 decades earlier had risen to become commanding generals. One of them was Mahmoud Ahmed, the Director General of the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, or ISI, Pakistan's most powerful intelligence agency, the seat of the country's covert operations to aid Taliban rule in Afghanistan. Smith and Mahmoud shared an interest in military history. Over the years, they had enjoyed dinner at each other's houses. During his tour in the mid-1990s, Smith had run a military history club for Islamabad expatriates. Mahmoud was then Director General of Military Intelligence, a separate organization from ISI that concentrated on battlefield information and India's military deployments. At that time, the United States had imposed economic sanctions on Pakistan because of its nuclear program. Relations between the two countries were badly strained. Still, Mahmoud visited Smith's house to talk to his history club about Pakistan's 1965 war with India, a subject the Pakistani general had studied closely. Mahmoud had an abiding interest in the American Civil War. He could talk for hours about the tactical decisions of Robert E. Lee and George Meade. Mahmoud embodied all the contradictions and mysteries that Pakistan's top generals presented to their American counterparts. He wore a bushy gray mustache and aviator sunglasses, carried a swagger stick as part of his uniform, and salted his monologues about history and war with references to Western literature. He played tennis. His wife was well-educated, as was his daughter. The general once told a CIA officer in Pakistan that he and his daughter were reading Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time together, so they could discuss its theories of the universe. At the same time, Mahmoud served as the paymaster of the obscurantist Taliban, and through them, as Al-Qaeda's enabler in Afghanistan. In this, he carried out Pakistan's national policy. The country had lost three wars with India since its establishment as an independent Muslim homeland in 1947, birthed from the ashes of the British Empire. Despite repeated battlefield failures, Pakistan's generals had enriched and empowered themselves over decades by cultivating a nationalism that stoked the fear that India sought to weaken and dismember their country. After winning the 1971 Indo-Pakistani War, India had severely damaged Pakistan by fostering the establishment of independent Bangladesh, formerly East Pakistan. By 2001, however, India was decoupling from its long rivalry with Pakistan. India's economy was booming. Its generals and foreign policy strategists professed to be more concerned about China than about their dysfunctional sibling neighbor to the west. Yet the Pakistan Army used fear of India as a justification for dominating Pakistan's politics. Pakistan had a smaller population and a weaker industrial base than India. To compensate, the army had built nuclear bombs to deter an Indian military invasion. To destabilize its enemy and to pursue Pakistan's decades-old goal of acquiring all of disputed Kashmir's territory, ISI covertly armed, trained, and infiltrated Islamist rebels into Indian-held Kashmir, where the guerrillas blew up police stations, carried out kidnappings, and assaulted Indian army posts. Pakistan's top military leaders directed the ISI, an institution of about 25,000 people. The spy service had three distinct categories of employees. There were senior leaders like General Mahmoud, who spent the bulk of their careers in the Army, Navy, or Air Force, and then rotated through the intelligence service in supervisory roles on tours of 2 to 4 years. The second group consisted of active military officers of the rank of colonel or below, who had been directed into ISI after failing to make the cut for promotion to generalship. Two-thirds or more of Pakistan Army officers rising through the ranks were not destined to become generals, so at a certain point, they were assigned to branches of service where they could rise as high as colonel. Some went into logistics, others into administration, and some entered into careers in intelligence, which allowed some of them to serve in uniform at ISI for many years. The presence of these officers in the middle-upper ranks of ISI further connected the institution to the Pakistan military's leadership. Still, the day-to-day work, even within ISI's less secretive directorates, could be very different from the military because of the strict compartmentalization of information. An officer would not have any idea what the guy in the next office was doing. Information was telescoped to the top, where only the most senior generals had complete visibility. There was also a large civilian component of ISI, working under contract. These ranks included watchers and thugs who kept track of foreign diplomats and other surveillance targets in Islamabad, Lahore, Karachi, and elsewhere. They also included specialists who manipulated and intimidated politicians and journalists. The civilians cultivated an aura of menace and self-importance. They allowed military officers to keep their distance from the roughest business, including murder, if they chose. The range of ISI's activity within Pakistan and outside the country was vast. The service was organized into a series of directorates underneath the Director General, who was always a serving three-star general as Mahmud was. Two-star generals led the major directorates. There were full directorates or subsidiary wings dedicated to counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and Pakistani domestic politics, for example. The Analysis Directorate was a prestigious post that produced white papers and memos and managed international liaison. ISI ran stations in Pakistani embassies devoted to spying abroad. A technical directorate managed eavesdropping in liaison with the Army's Signal Corps. Buried in this bureaucracy lay the units devoted to secret operations in support of the Taliban, Kashmiri guerrillas, and other violent Islamic radicals. Directorate S, as it was referred to by American intelligence officers and diplomats. It was also known as S-Wing, or just S. During the Cold War, the KGB also had a Directorate S that ran the spy service's illegals operations, meaning espionage carried out by trained officers and agents who operated abroad under deep cover. The ISI version had similar aspects, if an entirely different ideological basis. Directorate S partially resembled the CIA's Special Activities Division, in charge of covert paramilitary operations. Officers inside ISI sometimes used other names for the external operations units, the Afghan cell, the Kashmir cell, Section 21, or Section 24. Veterans of Pakistan's Special Services Group, a commando organization, primarily staffed the ISI's covert war cells, just as the CIA drew its paramilitary specialists from the ranks of U.S. Special Forces. To enlarge Pakistan's sphere of influence in Afghanistan during the 1990s, Directorate S covertly supplied, armed, trained, and sought to legitimize the Taliban. That a tennis-playing Gettysburg aficionado oversaw these operations was not remarkable. Black-label-sipping Pakistani generals with London flats and daughters on Ivy League campuses had been managing jihadi guerrilla campaigns against India and in Afghanistan for two decades. By 2001, however, CIA and DIA analysts were circulating reports that some ISI and Army officers had become increasingly influenced by the radical ideologies of their clients. This raised the possibility that generals with a millenarian or revolutionary outlook might capture the Pakistani state and its nuclear bombs. The classified reports singled out Mahmud Ahmed as one Pakistani general who had undergone a religious conversion, to the point where, in Mahmud's case, his evident personal enthusiasm for the Taliban appeared to go well beyond considerations of Pakistani national interest, as a CIA officer who worked with the general later put it. Mahmud considered this a misunderstanding. He had not suddenly become religious. He had been conservatively faithful since school days. The issue arose, he felt, only because he had risen to command of ISI and had therefore come under intense scrutiny. Dave Smith's superiors at DIA had hoped that his long friendship with Mahmud might allow for deeper engagement with him. But after Smith arrived in Islamabad, Mahmud snubbed him. Smith thought he understood why. Mahmud had taken a lot of heat on visits to Washington over Pakistan's support for the Taliban, and he wanted to signal that he did not have much use for Americans anymore. The general's assistants told Smith he was too busy to meet, and they pushed him off on ISI's Director General of Analysis. Smith persisted. Finally, in May 2001, Mahmoud had invited his old friend to his office at ISI headquarters for tea and a chat. Islamabad is a planned capital dating to the 1960s, tucked into the Margalla Hills. It lacks the grandeur and beauty of Lahore, the Punjabi seat of Mughal tombs and gardens, and it evinces little of the ungoverned chaos of Karachi. It was designed as an international enclave, a kind of fantasy theme park of what a modernizing, prosperous Pakistan might eventually become. The city is laid out on a grid system. ISI's headquarters occupied an unmarked compound in the G6 section, nestled behind a 10-foot wall. The main ISI building was old and in need of renovation. It was so close to the main road, Kayabani Surawardi, that a well-placed truck bomb might damage it badly. The security measures at the ISI entrance in mid-2001 were not rigid, especially if Smith called ahead and provided his diplomatic car's license plate number. The ISI guards popped his trunk, used mirrors to check the chassis for any sign of explosives, made sure there were no unauthorized passengers in the vehicle, and waved him through. Smith's driver pulled inside and deposited the colonel at the front door. The ISI's chief of protocol escorted the American to the second floor. Mahmoud's modest-sized office lay away from the street. A portrait of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, hung on the wall behind the desk, a standard decoration in government offices. There was a large wooden plaque carved with the names and service dates of previous spy chiefs. Mahmoud directed Smith to a sofa. An aide joined them to take notes. Smith pulled out his own pad and pen. A chaprasi served tea, cakes, and sandwiches, and then withdrew. Smith said he hoped to hear Mahmoud's views about the role of Islam in the Pakistan army. Mahmoud said he would be happy to discuss it, but first he had to provide some context. Mahmoud was notorious for long monologues. Here came another. This part of the world is still going through a demographic metamorphosis. It is still recovering from colonialism, the ISI director said. There's a lot of resentment toward the West. Moreover, he continued, Islam is misunderstood in the West. Islam sees no distinction between religion and the state. This had been true of Christianity in Europe for many centuries, until the Enlightenment, Mahmoud added. The Pakistan army is not completely insulated from this thinking, he went on, meaning that the army enlists soldiers who have been raised in village settings where there is no separation of church and state. Enlisted men learn all kinds of prejudices from village mullahs before they even enter the army. In recent years, the army had tried to teach them a moderate faith, he said, and had placed a great deal of emphasis on re-education. The great majority of Pakistanis, and especially the rank and file of the army, were motivated, conservative, and stable Muslims. In the mid-1990s, he had been assigned command of Pakistan's 23rd Division, headquartered at Jhelum, near the heavily militarized line of control that divided Kashmir between de facto Indian and Pakistani sovereignty. There, on the front lines, Mahmoud said, brother Pakistan army officers had urged him to re-examine his faith. I knew my military topics, but was ignorant about religion. The men would come to me for military advice, but go to the Malvi for moral guidance. In my pursuit of unity of command, it was necessary for me to educate myself about religion. I took it upon myself to study Islam, he said. I wanted unity of command, both tactical and moral. This was not an outlook that should alarm the United States, Mahmoud continued. Islam in Pakistan was becoming conservative and orthodox, not revolutionary. That is, it might be considered fundamentalist, but it did not seek political upheaval. The Taliban, Mahmoud believed, represented a similar strain of faith. From the American perspective, an essentially harmless, inward-facing orthodoxy. Smith wrote up the conversation and circulated his account in reporting cables. His account did little to calm those at CIA and the Pentagon, who feared that ISI was commanded by a politically restless, religiously recommitted general who oversaw what amounted to an alliance between a nuclear state and Al-Qaeda. That summer, following Smith's encounter amid the surge of alarming reports about Al-Qaeda's plans for a big attack, the United States redoubled its efforts to cultivate Mahmoud, in the hope that the ISI chief might use his influence with the Taliban's leadership to persuade them to either expel or betray Osama bin Laden. George Tenet flew secretly to Pakistan to meet with Mahmoud. To reciprocate for his hospitality to Tenet, the CIA invited Mahmoud to Washington and promised to arrange high-level meetings across the new Bush administration and in Congress. The ISI director's visit was to end on September 9th, and Mahmoud and his wife were booked on the Pakistan International Airlines flight out of New York on the evening of September 10th. However, he stayed to accept a late invitation to have breakfast at the Capitol on the morning of September 11th with Porter Goss and Bob Graham, the chairs of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, respectively. They were mid-meal when aides rushed in, shouting that they had to evacuate immediately. Wendy Chamberlain, the newly arrived U.S. ambassador to Pakistan in 2001, was a career Foreign Service officer who had been posted previously to Laos, Malaysia, and Zaire. It was about 7:30 p.m. in Pakistan when United Airlines Flight 175 struck the South Tower. She called Dave Smith and half a dozen other senior aides to her upstairs living quarters within the embassy compound, where she had CNN on the television. As they watched in shock and discussed security measures, the ambassador's young daughters sat at a desk to one side, doing their homework. General Tommy Franks, in charge of Central Command, the military headquarters that had responsibility for the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, called her the next morning. "You need to tell Musharraf they're either with us or against us," Franks told Chamberlain, referring to General Pervez Musharraf, Pakistan's president and chief of army staff. "They need to get a very strong statement out as soon as possible." But Chamberlain did not report to the Pentagon. She waited for instructions from Colin Powell at the State Department before she telephoned Musharraf. Musharraf was on a ship in the Arabian Sea, observing naval exercises. "You should be very clear that you support the United States at this time," Chamberlain said when she reached him by satellite phone. "Come on, Wendy. Al-Qaeda could not have done this," Musharraf said. "They're in caves. They don't have the technology to do something like this." "General, frankly, I disagree. They did this with box cutters." The next afternoon, September 12th, Dave Smith drove to the Pakistan Army's general headquarters in Rawalpindi, near Islamabad, to meet Tariq Majid, the two-star general who ran military intelligence. He worked in an L-shaped building that also housed Musharraf's official army office. As commander of the military and president, Musharraf had offices in both Rawalpindi and Islamabad. The inevitable portrait of Jinnah hung on one wall. A small door led off the main office to a map room filled with current intelligence charts depicting Indian military deployments. Smith was the rare outsider who got a glimpse of the uncovered estimates. Majid was another of the Pakistani officers he had befriended two decades earlier. Smith asked how the Pakistan Army's commanders were reacting to the attacks on New York and Washington. Majid said that India's External Intelligence Service, the Research and Analysis Wing, or RAW, was planting false rumors to implicate Pakistan in terrorism and the attacks. "There is concern that hostile states like India will use the attacks to gain an advantage over Pakistan," he said. He added that he was not convinced that Al-Qaeda was responsible for the hijackings. "It's one possibility, but there are others, the Red Army faction, or some similar European group," he said, referring to Marxist radicals of the Cold War era, now mostly defunct. He also mentioned Pakistanis who were living in Bolivia as possible suspects, a theory so far-fetched that Smith wasn't sure what to say. In Washington, Powell and Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage drafted seven requirements to be presented to Pakistan as a with us or against us ultimatum. Armitage delivered the list to Mahmoud in the form of a non-paper or unofficial memo at a business-like State Department meeting on September 13th. Mahmoud pointed out, "The inconsistency of U.S. attitudes toward Pakistan since our creation and the hostile feelings it has engendered among our people against the U.S. The same demands came to Wendy Chamberlain as written instructions. She had a previously scheduled meeting with Mashal.